This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, with The Week magazine of 30th. House GOP pushes ahead on deficit-boosting tax bill. House Speaker Mike Johnson battled this week to secure the passage of President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, attempting in a blitz of negotiating and arm-twisting to unite his fractious GOP caucus around the cornerstone of Trump's legislative agenda. The bill would lock in Trump's 2017 tax cuts, which are due to expire at year's end, while shrinking taxes on tips and overtime pay. It also allocates hundreds of billions of dollars toward immigration enforcement, the border wall, and defense to offset tax cuts that would cost an estimated $3.8 trillion over a decade. The bill would cut federal funding for food stamps by $267 billion, scrap clean energy tax credits passed under former President Biden, and cut an estimated $625 billion from Medicaid, mainly by establishing work requirements. Republican hardliners argued for steeper spending cuts opposed by GOP moderates, who also want a higher cap on the amount of state and local taxes residents can deduct from their federal taxes. Trump traveled to Capitol Hill to whip grandstanders into line, but as the week went to press, Johnson, who needs all but three GOP votes, was still wrangling amid a marathon session. If it passes the House, the bill is expected to be changed substantially by the Senate. As fiscal hawks decried the bill's cost, Moody's downgraded the nation's AAA credit rating for the first time in more than a century, citing large annual fiscal deficits and the surging cost of servicing a national debt that has swelled to $36 trillion. The Republican bill would add an estimated $3.3 trillion to the debt over a decade, according to the Penn-Wharton budget model. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says the debt could reach 129% of the U.S. economy by 2034. We are entering uncharted territory, said CRFB President Maya McGuinness. There is nothing beautiful about a bill that strips health coverage from low-income Americans while exploding the national debt, said the Austin American-Statesman. The Medicaid restrictions, which would require able-bodied recipients without children to work at least 80 hours a month, would leave an extra 8.6 million Americans uninsured, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. Throw in tax cuts favoring the rich, and the bill would boost income for the richest 10% of Americans while lowering them for the bottom 10%, says the CBO. That's a disastrous step backward. Moody's has stated the obvious, said the Wall Street Journal. Our fiscal path is unsustainable. The real problem is spending, which neither party is willing to attack. DOGE has cut around the edges, but Trump won't touch Medicare or Social Security, and too many Republicans won't even fix Medicaid, which has soared since Obamacare expanded coverage to able-bodied young men. The timing of Moody's downgrade wasn't accidental, said Heather Long in the Washington Post. It wanted to send a message to Republicans who are about to make a dire situation worse. For a marker of how scary the debt is getting, consider this. In 2021, 9% of federal revenue went to paying interest on the debt. Last year, it was 18%. By 2035, debt service will swallow almost a third of revenue, Moody's estimates. As the walls close in, investors are in sell America mode, seeing unprecedented risk in U.S. assets. While it ratchets up the debt, the bill would also slash nearly $1 trillion from bedrock safety net programs, said Tammy Luby in CNN.com. That will hurt millions, including many of the vulnerable Americans the GOP has promised repeatedly to protect, among them children, the disabled, and senior citizens. More than 71 million Americans are enrolled in Medicaid, and roughly 42 million receive food stamps. A great number are from rural areas that overwhelmingly support Trump, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. Nearly half of rural children get health insurance through Medicaid, and one in seven rural households uses food stamps. All in all, this is a terrible bill, said Dylan Matthews in Vox. But for Republicans, it's also startlingly normal. For all the talk of a new populist Republican Party, and for all Trump has upended tradition and shattered norms, it seems the GOP remains in thrall to the principles that have defined it for decades, taking from the poor, giving to the rich, and showering money on defense. Politics under Trump may have gotten extremely weird, but for the GOP, Trump's big, beautiful bill is business as usual. It wasn't all bad. When Miranda Gonzalez adopted her cat Holly in 2010, she promised to throw a quinceañera, a Latin American celebration marking a girl's transition into adulthood, if the feline made it to 15. It was anybody's guess whether Gonzalez, who had since gotten married and had two kids, would follow through. But in May, she and 40 guests feted Holly with cake and a mariachi band. Gonzalez asked attendees to donate to a local pet adoption center. After the quinceañera went viral, the center raised $3,400. A giant model railway with 3,500 feet of track was saved when a comedian stepped in to buy its home in Rocky Hill, New Jersey. A house in New Jersey has served as the meeting place for the Pacific Southern Railway Club since 1964, when the original owner started building the railroad. The succeeding two owners have been presidents of the club. When the house went up for sale, it appeared that the epic set, including a replica of a traveling circus, would be dismantled. But James Murray, star of the TBS show Impractical Jokers, stepped in to buy the house, railroad and all. "Every time you walk upstairs to see the train layout," Murray said, "you'll see something new. It's inventive and imaginative." In December 2023, David Carpenter was browsing through Harvard Law's online digital archives, looking at a copy of the Magna Carta, the foundational 1215 charter that inspired the U.S. Constitution. The Harvard copy was assumed to be a much later duplicate, but the King's College London history professor realized it was one of seven copies signed by English King Edward I in 1300. The school authenticated the manuscript through spectral imaging. The kicker? One of the copies signed by Edward I sold in 2007 for $21 million. Harvard bought its specimen in 1946 for $27.50. Courts try to check administration on deportations. The Supreme Court gave the Trump administration a win this week and a loss last week, allowing it to revoke for now protected status for Venezuelan migrants, but preventing it from deporting dozens of men held in Texas under the Alien Enemies Act. A judge had earlier halted the administration's attempt to cancel the Biden-era extension of temporary protected status for almost 350,000 Venezuelans. The Supreme Court has now lifted that injunction while an appeals court reviews the case. In a separate 7-2 ruling, though, the justices extended a pause on the Texas deportations and sent the case to an appeals court. That ruling criticized the government's efforts to quickly remove the men, mostly Venezuelans the administration alleges are gang members, without allowing them time to contest their deportations in court. The ruling didn't address whether the use of the Alien Enemies Act is legal. Meanwhile, a federal judge in Boston sharply rebuked the administration this week at a hearing requested by lawyers for a group of immigrants who were told they were being sent to politically unstable South Sudan. U.S. District Judge Brian E. Murphy said those removals unquestionably violated his previous order barring rapid deportations to third-party countries and that the officials involved could face criminal charges. "This seems like it may be contempt," he said. He ordered the government to maintain U.S. custody of the 8 deportees once they landed. The plane apparently touched down in Djibouti, where the U.S. has a military base. The Supreme Court ruling allowing the administration to lift Venezuelans' protected status is a victory for the rule of law, separation of powers, and common sense, said National Review in an editorial. Weighing the danger to national security imposed by an influx of insufficiently vetted nationals from a hostile country plagued by gang violence is a matter for the current executive branch, not its predecessor or the courts. The justices weren't so deferential in their ruling on the Texas deportations, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post. The court ruled unanimously last month that migrants targeted under the Alien Enemies Act have a right to challenge their removal in court and must be given adequate time to do so. Yet a mere 2 weeks later, the administration tried an end run around that ruling by providing detainees only 24 hours notice of their impending deportations. That backfired. The justices don't like being played for chumps. In fact, the Supreme Court was so irate, it pointedly did not wait for the appeals court to weigh in, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. For 7 justices, it was not a close call. The government's attempt to disappear migrants to a foreign black site is egregiously unconstitutional. The ruling also shows skepticism that the administration is operating in good faith. The majority now appears to doubt whether this White House can be trusted to respect the rights of any migrants. Biden. Was there a cover-up? Joe Biden's announcement this week that he has stage 4 prostate cancer, which has spread to his bones, is a sad moment for the country, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But the former president owes the public more information, given that he left office only some 120 days ago. That a cancer this advanced escaped White House doctors' notice is confounding. Sure, blood tests for prostate cancer are not recommended after age 70. A spokesperson for Biden, now 82, said he was last tested in 2014. Yet Biden isn't your average octogenarian. He was president and had sought another 4 years in office. Many Americans are understandably suspicious about the announcement's timing, said Robbie Suave in Reason, since it came 2 days before the publication of a damning tell-all about Biden's cognitive decline during his presidency. In Original Sin, journalists Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson reveal how Biden would forget the names of close aides and rely on cue cards in cabinet meetings, and even failed to recognize longtime friend George Clooney at a fundraiser days before the disastrous June 2024 debate that forced him to quit the race. Until that point, Biden's family and campaign staff had actively tried to hide his advancing senility, and the media and top Democrats had happily looked the other way. Some Democrats now say we should move on from this cover-up out of respect for the cancer-stricken Biden. But we can be respectful to Biden while continuing to seek answers about who knew what and when. Don't blame the media, said David Von Drail in the Washington Post. Reporters documented Biden's increasing signs of frailty, his limited schedule, tentative gait, and fading voice, and voters' concerns about his age from the moment he took office. Was the behind-the-scenes reality worse than they described? Yes, we're learning, but reporters couldn't see what they couldn't see. As for the calls that Democratic leaders should have intervened sooner, it exaggerates their power. There is no working mechanism to stop a determined president from seeking re-election, and to Joe and Jill Biden, worries about his age were just another chance for scrappy Joey from Scranton to prove the doubters wrong once again. The media's Biden coverage was flawed, said Margaret Sullivan in The Guardian, but its reporting on Trump was far worse. While every Biden verbal flub launched fresh hand-wringing about the age issue, journalists routinely reached for normalizing adjectives like freewheeling and brash to describe the 78-year-old Donald Trump's nightly rants about the late great Hannibal Lecter and his explicit promises to govern as an autocrat. Biden's sad, complicated exit from politics is the last thing Democrats want to talk about, said Susan Page in USA Today. But their near lockstep insistence that Biden was on top of his game, even as speechwriters adapted to his diminished capabilities by shortening their sentences, partly explains why Kamala Harris lost and why only 17% of voters now have any optimism about the party's future. Democrats will never regain that trust unless they're open to reckoning with the past. But blaming Biden for everything is too simple, said Carlos Losada in the New York Times. If he'd dropped out earlier, it's not clear that any nominee would have had a compelling pitch to voters. For too long, Democrats have acted as the anti-Trump party and failed to explain exactly what they're for. History won't be kind to Biden, but Democrats should be mindful that it's easier to find a scapegoat than an identity. Only in America. A Houston man is suing Whataburger for up to $1 million, claiming the chain ignored his request for no onions. Demary Wilson alleges he suffered an allergic reaction from the onions, whose inclusion in his meal proves that Whataburger failed to act in accordance with the appropriate standard of care. Wilson's Whataburger lawsuit follows the dismissal of one he filed last year against Sonic Drive-In, which he also accused of serving him unwanted onions. A senior at Northeastern University demanded an $8,000 refund on her tuition after discovering that a professor had used ChatGPT to assemble course materials. Ella Stapleton said she found telltale signs of AI in her business teacher's slide presentations, including chatbot prompts, distorted text, and photos of office workers with extraneous body parts. Northeastern, which bars students from the academically dishonest use of AI, denied her refund request. It was a good week for dystopias after reality TV producer Rob Warsoff revealed he'd pitched the Department of Homeland Security on a game show in which desperate immigrants would compete for the prize of U.S. citizenship. The show, which has the working title of The American, would be a celebration of America, said Warsoff. It's not the Hunger Games. It was a good week for the cast of Jersey Shore after congressional Republicans inserted into their one big beautiful bill a provision repealing a 10% excise tax that was imposed on tanning salons in 2010. Can't get more MAGA than that, said former Trump advisor Stephen Ratner. It was a good week for sunny days after Sesame Street struck a new streaming deal with Netflix. The fate of the beloved children's series had been in doubt because of an expiring pact with HBO and President Trump's decision to cut federal funding for PBS, the show's home for the last half century. It was a bad week for habeas corpus, which Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem was asked to define during a Senate hearing. Noem said it is a constitutional right that the president has to be able to remove people from this country. In fact, habeas corpus is what guarantees a person's right to challenge in court their detention by the government. It was a bad week for fiction after the Chicago Sun-Times published an AI-generated summer reading list for 2025 filled with made-up books by real authors. Among the non-existent classics, Isabel Allende's Tidewater Dreams, described in the list as the author's first climate fiction novel. It was a bad week for restricted areas after a disoriented DoorDash delivery driver somehow crossed the security perimeter at Chicago's O'Hare Airport and drove around for several miles, potentially crossing several runways. This could have been really, really bad, said former air traffic controller Robert Mark. London, Kentucky, tornado carnage. Tornadoes centered on Kentucky's Laurel County killed 19 people this week, capping a two-week period in which storms killed at least 28, destroyed thousands of structures, and left at least 115,000 residents without power. The storms stretched from Texas to Kentucky, with Oklahoma and Nebraska confirming at least four tornadoes and North Texas seeing football-sized hailstones more than 4 inches in diameter. 7 people died in Missouri and 2 in North Virginia. But Kentucky was the hardest hit, bearing the brunt of the damage as a tornado rammed through the town of London and the surrounding Laurel County. One resident, Vanessa Mullins, survived by huddling in her bathroom with her son and her boyfriend. They heard cries from injured neighbors and emerged to find that the couple living next door to Mullins had died in each other's arms as their house was ripped apart. Palm Springs, California. Anti-life. A 25-year-old man exploded a bomb in a car parked outside a Palm Springs fertility clinic last week, killing himself and injuring 4 others in what authorities deemed a terrorist attack. The blast damaged numerous buildings and shattered windows for blocks. Authorities said Guy Edward Bartkus had nihilistic ideations and antinatalist views, believing it's morally indefensible to have children since life involves suffering. He was trying to live stream the bombing outside the American Reproductive Center's clinic when he was killed. It remained unclear whether he'd intended to commit suicide. The FBI is examining a manuscript it believed Bartkus had written, as well as an audio recording in which an unidentified speaker outlined a plan to attack an IVF clinic and called himself anti-life. Akil Davis, assistant director of the FBI's Los Angeles office, said, "Make no mistake, this is an intentional act of terrorism." Washington, D.C., January 6th, settlement. The Trump administration plans to pay almost $5 million to the family of Ashley Babbitt, who was killed by police as she stormed into the U.S. Capitol during the January 6th, 2021 riot, multiple news outlets reported this week. Babbitt's family filed a wrongful death lawsuit seeking $30 million last year, and lawyers announced they'd reached a settlement this week. Babbitt was in a crowd trying to break into the House Speaker's lobby when Capitol Police Officer Michael Byrd shot her. Prosecutors investigated Byrd but declined to criminally charge him. The $5 million payment would symbolize a concession from the Justice Department, which prosecuted almost 1,600 people connected to January 6th, only for President Trump to pardon nearly all of them when he took office. He's since suggested creating a compensation fund to make up for the pardoned insurrectionists' lost wages and opportunities. They were treated very unfairly, Trump said. New Orleans inside job. An employee at a New Orleans jail was arrested this week and charged with helping 10 inmates in a daring escape. Sterling Williams, a 33-year-old maintenance worker at the Orleans Parish Correctional Facility, shut off the jail's water last week, allowing the inmates, ages 19 to 42, to unscrew a metal toilet and sink from a cell wall. They cut into steel bars behind the toilet, creating a hole large enough to escape through. They left behind a taunting misspelled message to Easy LOL. Once outside, they scaled a wall and sprinted across a highway. Williams said one of the prisoners threatened to shank him if he didn't cooperate, and the only person monitoring the security system covering that section of the jail had stepped away to get food. It took officials about 7 hours to realize 10 inmates were missing. Five were recaptured, but five others remained at large. Washington, D.C., state visit. President Trump and South African President Cyril Ramaphosa clashed in a contentious Oval Office meeting this week as their conversation quickly devolved into an argument about the treatment of white South Africans. Ramaphosa insisted he'd come to Washington to repair his nation's deteriorating relationship with the U.S., but Trump repeatedly claimed that white South African farmers were the victims of land theft and genocide. Trump even dimmed the lights to show a video of South African opposition leaders encouraging violence against white farmers as South African-born Trump advisor Elon Musk, who has often raised the issue, looked on. Ramaphosa, who helped negotiate the end of apartheid in the 1990s, said that calls for violence against whites were completely against his government's policy. After the video ended, a reporter asked Trump about the jet Qatar recently gifted the president, prompting Ramaphosa to joke, "I'm sorry I didn't have a plane to give you," Trump replied. "I would take it." Vatican City. Fresh start. Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio met privately with the newly minted American Pope Leo XIV this week on a mission to reset relations with the Vatican. The late Pope Francis had implicitly rebuked President Trump by saying that building walls was not Christian and explicitly corrected Vance for saying that a Catholic tenet allows the faithful to prioritize love of family and compatriots over the rest of the world. Before being elected Pope, Leo shared an article on the same subject titled, J.D. Vance is Wrong. At the meeting, Vance conveyed Trump's invitation to host the Pope at the White House, while Leo gave Vance a small sculpture with the Italian inscription, "Peace is a fragile flower." Jerusalem, threats of sanctions. France, Canada, and the UK threatened this week to impose sanctions against Israel unless it ends the escalation of its military campaign in Gaza and allows humanitarian aid to flow into the battered Palestinian enclave. "The level of human suffering in Gaza is intolerable," the three Western allies said in a joint statement. "We will not stand by while Netanyahu pursues these egregious actions." Israel launched its latest air and ground offensive against Hamas last week, just as President Trump left the Middle East without securing a ceasefire deal. Gaza authorities said that the latest Israeli strike had killed hundreds of people and shut down the last functioning hospital in northern Gaza. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israeli forces still intend to take control of the entire Gaza Strip, but he did agree to allow a basic quantity of food to enter the enclave to prevent starvation among its 2 million people. Netanyahu said his decision to partially lift the blockade following pressure from Israel's closest friend in the world, including several U.S. senators, who told him they couldn't tolerate images of extreme hunger coming out of Gaza. But the UN said the few trucks being allowed in were not sufficient to prevent mass starvation. Aid groups warned that they had completely run out of food, that armed groups had looted warehouses, and that dozens of children had already died of malnutrition. UN Aid Chief Tom Fletcher described this week's aid deliveries as a drop in the ocean of what is urgently needed. Doha, Qatar, a suggested donation. The U.S. formally accepted a lavishly outfitted Boeing 747-8 from Qatar this week, a transfer the Trump administration called a gift. But the emirate had originally been looking to sell the $200 million palace in the sky, the New York Times reported this week. It was the Trump administration, the Times said, that approached Qatari officials in the assumption that they would offer to donate it to the U.S. for free, with Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff playing a key role. Witkoff has strong ties to Qatar, whose sovereign wealth fund bailed him out in 2023 and whose prime minister attended his son's wedding. Critics in Congress have said that accepting such a gift from a foreign country poses both ethical issues and possibly insurmountable security concerns. It would cost the U.S. more than $1 billion to strip down and retrofit the jet to align it with Air Force One security specs. Kind's life with Clooney. Richard Kind lived out a failed sitcom in real life, said Michael Shulman in The New Yorker. In 1987, the prolific character actor was cast in a pilot for Bennett Brothers, in which Kind and George Clooney played siblings and roommates. He was the guy who got all the women, and I was the nebbishy guy, says Kind, 68. We all thought it was going to go. It didn't go. What are you going to do? So soon after, Clooney, who was going through a divorce, moved into Kind's Los Angeles apartment for a few months. One night, while watching TV together, Kind remarked that his cat had been constipated for a few days. Clooney decided to do this joke. He took a dump in the litter box. I came in and went, "I mean, it's huge." And George, at the time among us friends, had a terrible gastro system. That holiday season, Clooney asked if they could get a Christmas tree. I said, "George, you know I'm not that Jewish, but I can't have a Christmas tree. Put up holly, anything. I just can't have a Christmas tree." Clooney didn't relent. While carrying pies to a holiday party, the pair spotted a parking lot tree sale. He goes, "Come on, I can't buy a tree." I go, "George, I can't do it." He throws the pies at me in the parking lot. We were hilarious. We weren't working at the time. A Pussy Riot's Faded Dreams. Nadja Tolokonikova is disillusioned but not hopeless, said Philip Olterman in The Guardian. The Russian artist made headlines worldwide in 2012 when the group she co-founded, Pussy Riot, staged what it called a punk prayer in a Moscow cathedral. Western media heralded the protest as a spark that could ignite a revolution against the regime of President Vladimir Putin. But that uprising never came. Putin remains in the Kremlin, and Tolokonikova had to flee into exile abroad. "I think it's awesome that you guys romanticized Russian society," says Tolokonikova, 35. "The fact that you saw it as strong may have been a factor in it believing it actually was." She is still a working artist, but supplements her income with an account on the adult content platform OnlyFans, where she posts erotic self-portraits. "It's honest work. One needs to eat and pay the bills and pay for the kids' education, and that's how I do it. Political art is not a good business strategy." Tolokonikova has felt defeated since the invasion of Ukraine and the death of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. She still believes in the power of art, but these days I feel like the musician from the movie Titanic who was playing the violin. He can't stop the ship from sinking, but he can lift the spirits of people while they are going down. Taylor Swift and Blake Lively are no longer besties. The Bad Blood singer and the Gossip Girl actress have been pals since 2015, but their friendship halted after Swift was drawn into Lively's legal battle with her It Ends With Us co-star and director Justin Baldoni, a source told People. Taylor wants no part in this drama. Lively, 37, sued Baldoni in December, accusing him of sexual harassment and a retaliatory smear campaign. Baldoni, 41, countersued Lively for defamation and extortion. He name-dropped Swift in his filing, claiming Lively referred to the pop superstar as one of her dragons who protects her in creative matters. Baldoni subpoenaed the singer as a witness earlier this month, a move that fractured Swift's already fragile relationship with Lively, said an insider. Another source said that while the pair are taking some space, they are not no longer friends. The Los Angeles Police Department opened a criminal investigation into Smokey Robinson last week after the Motown legend was accused of rape and sexual assault by four former housekeepers. In the civil suit, which seeks $50 million in damages, one of the women alleges she was assaulted by the Tears of a Clown singer, 85, at least 23 times from 2014 to 2020. John Harris, a lawyer for the plaintiffs, said his clients earned below minimum wage and did not come forward previously for fear of reprisal, losing pay, and public embarrassment. An attorney for Robinson denies the allegations, calling them manufactured. Jurors at the federal sex trafficking trial of Sean Diddy Combs heard this week from multiple witnesses about the rap mogul's alleged abuse of his ex-girlfriend, Cassandra Ventura. Don Richard, a singer, told the Manhattan court how from 2009 to 2011 she saw Combs repeatedly punch and kick Ventura, who prosecutors allege was forced by Combs to have sex with male prostitutes. Combs denies Richards' claim. Later, the court was shown photos of Ventura's bruised body, images her mother Regina said she took when Ventura came home for Christmas in 2011. That same year, Regina said, Combs demanded $20,000 from her and threatened to release sex tapes of Ventura because he was unhappy she was in a relationship with rapper Kid Cudi. Regina said she paid up to protect my daughter's safety. Combs' defense attorney declined to cross-examine Regina. The threat to the NIH. The Trump administration plans drastic cuts to medical research. What are the ramifications? What is the National Institutes of Health? It's the largest funder of biomedical research in the world by far, and the force behind some of the biggest medical breakthroughs of the 21st century. Begun as a single-room laboratory in a Staten Island hospital in 1887, the NIH has ballooned into a $47 billion organization with thousands of employees. Through grants to hundreds of thousands of researchers, the NIH has aided in the discovery of semaglutide, weight loss drugs, HIV retrovirals, and life-saving leukemia treatments. Virtually every drug approved in the U.S. since 2010 was developed with some NIH funding, but this money is drying up. Earlier this month, President Trump accused the agency of wasteful spending, misleading information, risky research, and the promotion of dangerous ideologies, and released a budget blueprint that would dramatically slash NIH funding by 40%. Many experts fear the cuts will throttle medical research for decades to come. That means, says John Hopkins pulmonologist Theodore Iwashina, the lives of my children and grandchildren, and maybe yours, will be shorter and sicker. How does the NIH operate? The vast agency comprises 27 centers, including the National Cancer Institute, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and similar institutes for everything from environmental health to diabetes to strokes. Each institute selects which research projects in its particular field should be funded, and it does that by setting priorities and submitting each proposal to a peer review process using outside experts. Some of the research takes place in-house at the NIH's campus in Bethesda, Maryland, but 85% of its budget is earmarked for grants. Each year, its institutes award 60,000 projects across some 2,500 institutions, with much of the money going to leading research facilities such as Johns Hopkins University, the University of California, San Francisco, and the University of Michigan. These grants typically allow up to 5 years to complete the project, offering a level of stability usually not available through private philanthropy. What has this research accomplished? It has saved millions of lives. An NIH-developed vaccine virtually eliminated the most common cause of bacterial meningitis, and NIH-backed therapies have helped push cancer deaths down 34% since 1991. Former NIH director Francis Collins helped discover the gene responsible for cystic fibrosis, a disorder that once killed sufferers in young adulthood, but now, with NIH-funded therapies, can be manageable for decades more. Findings from the ongoing Framingham Heart Study, which began in 1948, have shaped much of today's cardiovascular care. And years of NIH-funded mRNA vaccine research enabled scientists at pharmaceutical companies to develop a COVID vaccine in just 6 months, kicking off a global vaccination campaign that saved 14 million lives worldwide. Yet the COVID pandemic turned the NIH into a political lightning rod. What happened during the pandemic? As the understanding of the virus evolved, the NIH's public messaging took dizzying turns. Anthony Fauci, longtime director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, went from saying there is absolutely no reason whatsoever to mask up in February 2020, when authorities feared shortages for the healthcare providers, to recommending mask mandates a few months later. School closures supported by the NIAID led to mental health problems and learning loss among students. The debate over whether COVID originated from a Wuhan market or the Wuhan virology lab made many suspect a cover-up, the more so when it came out that NIH officials tried to shield official correspondence from public view. Many Republicans blamed Fauci personally and the NIH generally for bungling the pandemic response, and they pointed to funding for things like a text messaging service advising teen girls about various sex acts as evidence that the agency was too politicized. There was a real erosion in trust in those agencies, says Joel Zinberg, a surgeon and special assistant to President Trump. The second Trump administration promised radical reforms. What has the administration done? Shortly after Inauguration Day, it froze NIH funding. It has since laid off nearly 5,000 NIH staffers and contractors, and those who remained were barred from funding new research. Some 800 grants already awarded were abruptly terminated mid-study, wasting the tens of millions of taxpayer dollars already spent. Many of these were DEI-related, because they addressed health inequities, for example, or LGBTQ needs, or looked at drug variation by sex or ethnicity, and others involved topics like vaccine hesitancy or climate change. Now the administration is proposing to introduce term limits, so no institute director would become as powerful as Fauci was, and to collapse the 27 institutes down to 15. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and NIH Director J. Bhattacharya have promised to focus less on infectious diseases and more on chronic conditions, as well as to defund any research infected with political ideology. What happens now? It's unclear. There are several lawsuits contesting the administration's authority to yank funding from studies already underway and challenging its directive to cap the amount of a grant used for indirect lab costs. But in the meantime, the funding halts have caused universities to freeze hiring, forcing young postdoctoral medical researchers to decide between leaving their field or leaving the country. We're likely to see fewer medical breakthroughs, fewer vaccines, fewer new treatments, and the patients in the canceled studies, including trials for treatment of cancer, addiction, and long COVID, are left in limbo. When your clinical trial is taken away, says Alzheimer's patient Beth Humphrey, 68, you're left with nothing but the disease. Is this Georgia or Gilead? Welcome to Gilead, said Monica Hesse of the Washington Post. Every week, America is becoming more and more like the totalitarian, patriarchal society depicted in Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. Consider the ongoing horror show in Georgia, where Adriana Smith, an Atlanta nurse in her ninth week of pregnancy, was declared brain dead after blood clots formed in her brain. Against the strong wishes of her family, a hospital is keeping Smith alive with a ventilator and a feeding tube because state law forbids abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. The exception to save the life of the mother doesn't apply, since Smith's life can't be saved. Smith's pregnancy is now 21 weeks along with 11 more to go, and doctors have found fluid on the fetus's brain. Smith's mother said, "It is torture for me to watch machines keeping her daughter from dying peacefully." Meanwhile, her family's hospital bills are mounting. Smith is being treated as an incubator in the most literal sense of the word. State Republicans are justifying this grotesquerie by insisting that the baby must be saved, revealing that the lives of women do not matter. This nightmare is not dystopian fiction. It is our post-Roe reality. How they see us, the myth of white genocide. America is now for whites only, said Tom Eaton in Business Day of South Africa. If you're being starved in Gaza or bombed in Sudan, sorry, kids. President Donald Trump has closed America's doors to actual refugees. But if you're an Afrikaner, descendants of the white Dutch minority that ruled South Africa under apartheid, you can waltz right in because Trump has swallowed the lie that Afrikaners are being slaughtered on their farms and a racist government is seizing their land. A few dozen white South Africans have already jumped at this chance to resettle in the U.S., signing up to be the poster children of white nationalist grievance mythology. Are these emigrants simply racists, or are they really being persecuted? In fact, it's neither. They're economic migrants taking advantage of perverted politics to get a toe in the door of the world's biggest economy. I expect they'll regret it once they realize they can no longer hire a domestic worker for $10 a day. Afrikaners' biggest gripe has been that their kids must learn English rather than Afrikaans, said Makudu Sefara in the Sunday Times of South Africa. But it's hard to imagine a quicker way of killing Afrikaans than packing your children off to Idaho. The Trump administration has gone further than even the Afrikaner political parties, said Farouk Chotia in the Namibian of Namibia. They don't say they fear genocide. It's white supremacists in America who are spreading that lie. Trump's first buddy, the South African-born billionaire Elon Musk, claimed that black politician Julius Malema was actively promoting race-based violence when he used to sing the old apartheid-era resistance anthem, "Shoot the Boer," at his rallies. But the Supreme Court has ruled that no reasonably well-informed person would take the lyrics as a call to actual violence, and in February, a judge dismissed the idea of a genocide as clearly imagined and not real. Musk tried to paint a picture of rampaging black mobs attacking white farmers, said Christian Voren in Die Zeit of Germany. The truth is more nuanced. A few white farmers really have been killed. South Africa has extreme inequality and shocking levels of violence, and both are legacies of apartheid. But the attackers have slain far more black farm workers than white landowners. Musk's real motive is personal greed. a law requiring foreign companies to share business with communities disadvantaged during apartheid, has held up licenses for his Starlink internet service, and he recently posted on X, "Starlink is not allowed to operate in South Africa because I am not black." That is an impressive example of whining, but it's not true. As a blue blood Afrikaner, I was bewildered when Trump declared we're a threatened species, said Max Dupreez in The Guardian of the UK. Afrikaners are actually better off today than when apartheid fell in 1994. Whites aren't being dispossessed. We still own 72% of farmland, despite making up just 7% of the population. While a new law would allow expropriation of farms under certain circumstances, it has yet to be implemented. Not a single Afrikaner has been kicked off his land. Whites here live in a genuinely pluralistic open society, one that other democracies, especially Trump's America, can be jealous of. Law, the battle over birthright citizenship. President Trump is hoping that a bit of legal chicanery will let him shred birthright citizenship, said Stephen I. Vladek in the New York Times. Three federal judges have barred the administration from enforcing his January executive order, which, in a clear violation of the 14th Amendment, would deny U.S. citizenship to the children of undocumented migrants. But during oral arguments at the Supreme Court last week, administration lawyers didn't ask the justices to rule Trump's order legal. Instead, they asked the High Court to scrap the use of nationwide injunctions. If the justices agree, lower courts would be able to block government agents only from acting against individual plaintiffs. Such a ruling would mean that, as this case progresses, children born to immigrants could be denied citizenship for any number of reasons, including the status of their parents' lawsuits. Meanwhile, nationwide freezes issued by judges on other Trump policies, such as the mass firings of government workers, would be voided. The Constitution is clear that all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. are American citizens, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. But there are practical and jurisprudential agreements against nationwide injunctions, as both liberal and conservative justices have long noted. Those orders encourage forums shopping for favorable judges, Republicans seeking out red state judges under Democratic presidents, and vice versa. They're also asymmetrical. If the government wins 9 times out of 10 on an issue, the people who lost the first 9 cases still get to win if their one victory results in a policy being blocked across the country. Executive overreach is the actual problem here, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. Solicitor General D. John Sauer complained to the Supreme Court that nearly 40 injunctions have been issued against the administration to date. The Obama administration received 12 in 8 years. But that's what happens when an out-of-control president ignores constitutional restraints. The court seems to recognize the need to bolster those restraints, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg. Conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch both grilled Sauer on whether scrapping universal injunctions would let unlawful executive orders remain in effect and cause real-world harm. That suggests the court will find a way to allow nationwide injunctions on the most egregious executive actions, and that the justices finally understand the importance of protecting the rule of law from Trump's threat. Your face reveals your health. A new AI tool can pinpoint your biological age from a selfie, reports the Washington Post. Doctors typically estimate biological age from a patient's looks, what they call the eyeball test, to help them determine appropriate therapies. A cancer patient who appears to be 72, but is really 65, for example, is less likely to tolerate aggressive treatment. The new tool, called Face Age, is designed to improve that initial judgment call. Scientists at Mass General Brigham in Boston trained the algorithm on some 60,000 photographs of people ages 60 and older. They initially tested it on a group of 6,200 cancer patients undergoing radiotherapy and found that the older the patient looked, the worse their survival rate. They then asked 8 doctors to predict whether terminal cancer patients would be alive in 6 months. Working off just a photo, the doctors were right 61% of the time. With clinical information, too, their success rate rose to 74%, and with face age, it rose to 80%. Irbaz Riaz, an assistant professor at Mayo Clinic who wasn't involved in the study, calls face age a promising early-stage tool that could help standardize the subtle visual assessments we make every day. Obesity begins in childhood. What kids eat and how much they run around in early childhood may be key to preventing obesity in years to come, a new study suggests. Kids who are overweight at age 6 are up to twice as likely as peers to be obese once they reach adulthood. Researchers in the Netherlands tracked the body mass index of more than 3,500 children at ages 2, 6, 10, 14, and 18. They found that every 1 unit rise in BMI at age 6 more than doubled the chances of the subject being overweight or obese when they came of age. Encouragingly, the same wasn't true for kids who were overweight as toddlers, but then hit a healthier weight before their 6th birthday, which suggests that early intervention could be crucial. The first 5 years of a child's life provide a fantastic opportunity to intervene and prevent them experiencing overweight and obesity in the years to come, co-author Jasmine de Groot from Erasmus University Medical Center in Rotterdam tells The Guardian. We need to understand how children grow and develop if we are to help future generations grow up healthier and give every child a chance at a happy, healthy life. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.